Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening. Yes.
Can you say two words about yourself and how long have you been here?
Certainly. My name is Scott. I've been at Canando for 8 years or something like that. Yes, before that I lived in Colorado. I came here to work for Google. So that's what I do as a day job. Tonight, I'll be giving a little talk about peace, and we'll be discussing one of the oldest Buddhist scriptures, the Book of Eights. I have a little bit prepared, and we have a lot to read, and I'd like to leave plenty of time for questions to discuss our own practice and how these ancient teachings can apply to us today. So to begin with, I'd like to ask all of you if you're comfortable to close your eyes and to cast your mind back through all the long years that you've lived on this earth, and to come across a memory of a time when you felt deeply at peace. This doesn't have to be an earth-shattering peace. It doesn't need to be profound. It doesn't need to be extraordinary. Just a regular time that you felt at peace is fine. And bring to mind what it was that you could see, what you could hear, if there was any smell, what you could taste in your mouth, and what you could touch. In this moment of peace for yourself, what was it that you felt in your body? And what was it that you saw in your mind? And how did you feel in your spirit? And taking a moment to open your eyes, I want to ask if there's anyone who will share just a sentence or two about what they were doing and how they felt. Yes, David. That's wonderful. Will anyone else share just a sentence or two? Yes, please. That's very nice. Maybe one more. Lee. That's wonderful. Thank you all for sharing your stories of your own internal peace. I'd like to share with you a little bit about the scripture that's sitting in front of you. You have in front of you a copy of a sutra called the Atadanda Sutra, which is the Discourse on Being Violent. And the translation we have is from Gil Fronsdal, who's at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City. So we're lucky to have a local translating for us these ancient teachings. This scripture is one of, I think, 16 that are in the Book of Eight. And the Book of Eight is part of an anthology of Buddhist teachings that are believed to be among the very oldest of all the sutras in the Pali Canon. It's thought that they were composed 2,500 years ago, possibly before the Buddha had even stopped wandering and settled down, sometime in that 20-year period between leaving home and finding a place in Jetta's Grove. What makes these teachings very special is that in this entire book, you find no references to any of the usual Buddhist listicles. There are no four noble truths. The third one will blow your mind. There's no eightfold noble path. What we find in these teachings are a very straightforward and direct explanation of peace. And both peace for yourself, personal peace, but also Buddha's vision for a new kind of society, a peaceful society. One of the ways that we know that this is among one of the oldest teachings is because it's referenced in teachings that are also very old. For example, we have a story about one of the Buddha's disciples, Sona. And the Buddha asked Sona, "Would you please recite the Dharma?" And what Sona did was to recite the entirety of the Book of Eights. That was what he meant by the Dharma. So we know that this set of sutras is very important to the Buddhists, to the early Buddhists, and that it was meant to be recited. The Buddha was not only an ascetic living in the woods by himself, but also a poet. And he leaves us this poetry. And because it was meant to be spoken and not to be read, I think we should read it tonight. Would someone like to read the first three verses?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Umar. Go ahead.
Violence gives birth to fear. Just look at people and their quarrels. I will speak of my dismay in the way that I was shaken. Seeing people thrashing about like fish in little water and seeing them feuding with each other, I became afraid. The world is completely without a core. Everything, everywhere things are changing. Wanting a place of my own, I saw nothing not already taken.
The Buddha begins this sutra by talking about his own experience. When he's referring to I here, he's talking about his own experience of pain and suffering before he uncovered the path. This sutra is believed to be delivered between the Sakyans, or the Shakyans, Buddha's clan, and a neighboring clan who were having a dispute over water rights. And the farmers of both villages had become irritated with each other because there was not enough water to go around, and they had come to blows and were standing on the banks of the river just about ready to tear each other apart. And the Buddha got word of this, and so he showed up, and these are the words that he said. Will someone read the next three?
I felt discontent at seeing only conflict to the very end. Then I saw an arrow here, hard to see, embedded in the heart. Pierced by this arrow, people dash around in all directions. When the arrow's pulled out, they don't run and they don't sink. Here the trainings are recited. Don't pursue what the world's knotted up in. Having pierced sensuality, Train in your own full release.
Who would like to read the next three? This little statement, "Here the trainings are recited," is actually believed to be an ancient editorial comment, that this is actually where the entire sangha was supposed to speak together. Go ahead.
Truthful, not impudent or deceptive, anger-free and never speaking divisively, a sage would overcome avarice and the evil of greed. One should conquer drowsiness, laziness, and sluggishness, and not lie negligently. A person intent on full release shall not be conceited. One shall not be pulled into false speech or become enamored with physical forms. One shall fully understand conceit and refrain from a violent life.
Who would like to read the next three?
One shouldn't delight in the old or prefer the new. One shouldn't grieve what's lost or cling to what's attractive. Greed I call the great flood, and desire a swift current. Objects of awareness are moving waves, and lust is a quagmire difficult to cross. Not deviating from truth, sages, Brahmins stand on dry ground. Giving up everything, they are said to be at peace.
It continues on to the back. Who would like to read the next three?
Knowing they are ones who know, knowing the Dharma, they are not dependent. Wandering properly through the world, they do not envy anyone here. They who have overcome lust, are clinging hard to overcome in this world, don't grieve or worry. They have cut the stream, they are unbounded. What was before, let it wither away. What will be later, do nothing with it. Not grasping what's in between, you'll live at peace.
The next three?
By not taking as mine anything that has name and appearance, and not grieving what doesn't exist, one is not diminished in this world. Who doesn't say this is mine, or that anything belongs to others, doesn't experience selfishness, and doesn't grieve thinking, I have nothing? When asked, I say, the benefit of being unshakable is being even-minded everywhere and being without cruelty, greed, and agitation.
Would someone like to read the last two?
For one who knows, who has no agitation, there is no karmic accumulation. Abstaining from karmic activity, one sees safety everywhere. Sages do not say they are inferior, superior, or equal to others. Peaceful, unselfish, they neither embrace nor reject.
Thank you. So what I find striking about this sutra is that there is no discussion of rebirth. The Buddha offers very practical advice for how to achieve peace in this lifetime, here and now. He doesn't refer to any kind of metaphysical powers. These are all things that people can do. In fact, when the Buddha lists the attributes of a person who is at peace, not running around, dashing about in all directions or flopping around like a fish out of the water. These are statements that I think we could find when our friends shared their discussion of their own personal peace. The Buddha is not talking about some kind of earth-shattering peace that can only be found in another lifetime or by another person, but by anyone here and now. In other words, the Buddha is saying, peace is possible in every moment. And he gives us advice for how to see it there. He says, pierced by this arrow, people dash about in all directions, and when the arrow is pulled out, they don't run and they don't sink. So pull out the arrow. In another sutra, the Buddha is being questioned by someone who wants to know all sorts of details about the Dharma. And the Buddha says, does a man who is pierced by the arrow refuse to have it pulled out because he wants to know who made the arrow? And why is it fletched this way? And where did the bird come from who gave the feathers for the arrow? No. He just pulls it out. In our society, we have a bunch of messages coming at us from all directions at all times telling us that peace is farther away, that peace is not here and now, peace is somewhere else, peace is in the future. Peace can come after you have a new car. Peace can come after you buy a new dishwasher. Peace will come when you have a new job and you can finally afford the nice things that you want in your life. We are bombarded by ads in our media that tell us that we need something else to make us happy. But the truth is that peace is here all around us, just waiting for us to open up and discover it. In this sutra, the Buddha lists a bunch of things that he considers to be obstacles to finding peace. Drowsiness, laziness, sluggishness, lying, false speech, being attached to physical forms. He also talks about wishing that things were different. Late at night when I go to walk the dogs, I can do this in two ways. One, I can wish that I was somewhere else. I can wish that I was already home in bed, asleep and warm, and not out here with these tiring dogs in the cold and the rain. Or I can accept that this is what I must do, and I can find my peace with it, and I can enjoy these few moments of quiet, walking in the moonlight. And so I would ask you, if you have the chance, look for a little peace in your own life. And don't wait. Does anyone have any thoughts about the sutra that we have read, or any questions? Bonnie.
When everyone was sharing their moments of peacefulness, and we hadn't even read the sutra yet, I noticed that they all had to do with water. So there was on being on a lake or looking at a waterfall or being in Hawaii at the beach. And mine personally was at Tassajara laying in this river and just like the waves going over me and the rocks were so soft they felt like pillows. And first of all, it's like the sacredness of nature and water. But then we get to this and it's all about water. People fighting over water and that causes chaos. And then he even uses analogies of water being problematic. Greed is like a great flood. Desire is a swift current. So when we think of tsunamis, we think of fear. We think of water in a different context. But what occurred to me with your comments about finding peace within ourselves is that a lot of times we look at a waterfall and we're like, wow, look at this nature. We see the ocean, we're like, wow, this nature. And we forget to look at ourselves and say, wow, I'm nature. And our own bodies are composed of like 80% water. So I think it just occurred to me that it's easy to see the beauty and the peace outside and overlook that it's right here. Yeah.
Thank you, Bonnie. I think you're right. And I think that's part of what our practice of meditation is here to encourage us to do. Because when you're facing the wall, you have to look inward. And I think it's only by training our attention on that opportunity to look inward that we learn to see that in ourselves.
So I had a question about the last verse. So this is 9:54, the mm-hmm. first two lines. So it says, sages do not say they are inferior, superior, or equal to others. So I found this kind of interesting because, like, intellectually, once you ban all those three, there's kind of nothing left there, right? So I guess my question is, what exactly does it mean? Does it just mean, like, sages, for example, do not even consider this something worthy of thinking about? Or is there something else to that?
That's a really excellent question. And I think what the Buddha is saying here is, if you adopt an attitude of inferior, superior, or the other way around, or equal, then you have inherently erected a barrier between me and you. You are saying, not the same. Not one substance, not one expression. And so I think you're right that the Buddha would discourage us from drawing those kinds of analyses. I will ask you a question. If the Buddhist hypothesis is that peace is possible in every moment, then how do I find peace when someone makes me really angry at them because they've done something unjust to me? Maybe they've eaten all the cheesecake and I didn't get any. That's a petty example. But suppose they've rear-ended my car. How do I find peace?
So I would say, I heard this recently and I'll share it with everyone, and I think it's a really good exercise to do, is when you find yourself in that moment, you have to say to yourself, I accept myself unconditionally right now. That's the first step that you take. And a shift will happen. Shift starts to happen. It is this realization, this deep realization, that, you know, I'm here right now, and if I'm accepting myself, this is it, you know. And to push it even further, I think we can take it from Alan Watts. He said, this is it, you're it, that's it. So go ahead, you know, create your own world out of that. So I was angry today, and I said that, and it was a shift happened, and I was able to do something that was impossible and for me. So I heard that from somebody, and he said, if you write this down and repeat it to yourself once a day for the next 30 days, you'll see your life turn a little bit in a different direction, in a much better direction. So I've been doing that for the past 5 days now, and it is helping. So once we were today talking, and I was angry at something, and she said, you're being very negative to me. And Lee. And I was like, okay. So I took that in, and I like start turning that around and start saying that to myself very quietly, and it changed my perspective.
I think another way of saying what you've said is that after someone's rear-ended you, it's okay to be angry, it's unjust. But that if you hold on to the anger, you're not doing yourself any favors by insisting that you think things should be other than that they are. That's what causes you to suffer.
Well, you're helping the economy because you'll get an ulcer and go to the hospital. insurance company makes money. Doctor gets paid. You know, you're helping.
And the cycle goes on and on. Huh? Yeah. Thank you, Umar.
So I was actually just recently dealing with this because a very close friend of mine, someone I looked up to a lot, was lying to me and manipulating me. And I was really not happy about that. And me being the kind of person I was, I actually, after I found out he was lying, I didn't let him know that I knew he was lying, and I kind of gave him several days to tell me the truth and said, oh, I felt really bad about this, and he would just go along with the story like, yeah, and he didn't, of his own volition, admit that he was lying. So I was getting more and more angry, and eventually I had to look inside, why is this happening to me? You know, what am I supposed to learn from this? And this isn't the first time I've had, you know, a friend betray me, but it always gets to me. And then I'm like, well, maybe it's here for a reason for me to learn something. And I start looking, what have I learned? I've learned how to tell when someone's lying, you know, how to test people. I've learned what relationships are good for me. I've learned what is my own attachment then to someone who's lying to me. Like, why would I then continue that relationship and focus on it? And I actually realized it had to do with some unhealed wounds from my past, my childhood, because my dad used to lie. And so I was kind of always trying to complete that. And I also realized that when something goes wrong, I had a tendency then to latch on to that person or get tunnel vision and just see that friend betrayed me, and then I'm a victim, the world is wrong, and I'm ignoring the fact that I might have hundreds or thousands of friends who are honest with me and support me, and all I can focus on is that one hurt. So I had to realize my part in it, that I am the one that chooses where I get to focus in my life, and if I'm focusing on the negative rather than saying, okay, see you later, and go hang out with my faithful friends, you know, that's on me. So I guess for me, what helped me to move forward was, what did I learn from this?
Thank you, Bonnie. That's very insightful. I think it's interesting that nowhere in here or anywhere else in the Book of Eights does the Buddha say, you shouldn't feel anything. Clearly, our emotions are here to tell us something. They're like our sense of touch. They mean that we've stubbed our toe against an injustice, or that we've discovered something in our lives that needs to change. And I think we use emotions skillfully when they prompt us to look inside ourselves and ask ourselves difficult questions about what needs to change and what needs to stay the same. I think that's good. Well done.
I find this verse interesting, the one that says by 950 on the back page, by not taking as mine anything that is name and appearance, and not grieving what doesn't exist, one is not diminished in this world. And I think that is one of the core things that meditation seems to do for us. It sort of loosens up this attachment to some ideal ego, some ideal identity that we think we have, that we are, that's fixed. And in loosening up that attachment to, oh, well, I come from here, and I'm from this family, and I do this for a living, and so forth, by loosening that up, we kind of open to a much deeper truth about our nature, our true nature. So I really like that verse, and I think that it's something that as meditators we all have to come to grips with, of letting go of that mind and appearance and persona that we become so attached to. So thank you.
That's very nicely said. I think I agree. I think if you're looking for an opportunity in your own life to find some more peace, you should look at the moment when you pull your cell phone out while you're standing in line at Starbucks. Because this is a moment where you are trying to distract yourself from what is happening right now. And you should take what Buddha has to say on line 949 to heart. This is a time not to worry about what will it be later. this is a time not to grasp. I think if you look at the number of times you pull out your cell phone when you wish you were somewhere else, these are all times in your life when you could be feeling peace. There's nothing stopping you except for putting your cell phone away and being there. Any other thoughts or questions?
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.